Welcome to How to Save Your Life. How to Save Your Life is produced with the assistance of the Department of Neurological Surgery, Weill Cornell Medical College, New York Presbyterian Hospital. Your host is Dr. Philip Stieg, Chairman of the Department of Neurological Surgery and Neurosurgeon-in-Chief at New York Presbyterian Hospital.
Welcome to How to Save Your Life. I'm your host, Dr. Philip Stieg. We are going to talk about your responsibility in managing your health care. Also, the insurance company's responsibility. Do you have health insurance? Can you afford health insurance? Once you've got it, can you navigate the complex system so that you get the appropriate treatment and you maintain a healthy lifestyle? Please stay with us for the answers to these questions and more. Welcome back to How to Save Your Life. Are you managing your health care? Do you have health insurance? Can you afford health insurance? And if not, what do you do? How do you navigate the health care system? Do you fit into a disease management group? We will answer these and many other questions regarding the complex task of managing your health care. It is my distinct pleasure to have as my guest Dr. Susan J. Bean, the Senior Vice President and Chief Medical Officer of Affinity Health Plan. This is a nonprofit independent health plan which is managed care. It is applied to and used for the underserved residents in the New York metropolitan area. She is an expert on the delivery of health care, and it is a distinct pleasure to have her here with us.
Thank you for having me.
Susan, how many people in the United States actually don't have insurance?
The number fluctuates, but it remains around 40 million United States residents.
And why do you think that's the case? I mean, why is the number so high? There's got to be multiple reasons, and you see many of them. Can you list them?
I think you're absolutely right that there are multiple reasons. Many people are working in jobs that actually do not supply health care. Most of us find our health care insurance is supplied by employers. We also have many who are not aware of how to access health care insurance, so they are without coverage. And then we have the interesting group that's sort of falling through the cracks because they're transitioning between jobs or have social economic disarray or reversal.
So, we won't spend a lot of time on this, but do you think that people that don't have insurance, can they still get good health care?
I think it's possible for them to get good health care, but there have been a number of studies that show that in actuality they probably are much less likely to have continuity of care and good health outcomes, especially when compared with those of us who are insured.
So when we're talking about good health care, we're probably then differentiating a little bit between emergent health care versus, like you said, continuity. So for the pregnant mother, it's not good, but for the person that gets shot and has no insurance, they probably get world-class care if they run into an emergency room.
That's probably right. I think that rather than saying good health care, I should probably qualify that and say quality in terms of not only what is received during the process of care, but also the outcomes that are achieved after the care is done. So we're looking for quality in terms of health outcomes.
Yeah, later on in the show, we'll get into the quality and outcome stuff. That's extremely interesting. I think real important for everybody to know about. In terms of, a little bit earlier, you said some people just don't know what's out there. I mean, how much of the problem is the system and how much of the problem is the patient or the individual?
It's a combination of both. I would start with the system, which is extremely difficult to understand and to navigate on one's own. Even having healthcare insurance, as probably we both do, it's very difficult to know when you're supposed to use your benefits, what the benefits are, what the copays are. Do you have a PCP, a primary care doctor, that you have to find first? And so lining up all of those rules and actually using them is very difficult.
Before the show, you and I were talking about a patient that we've had experience with, a delightful young lady that had a brain tumor, and she just couldn't navigate the system, and it wasn't because she wasn't intelligent. The system just somehow always put roadblocks in there. Are there any changes that are going to come that will, if I make a phone call, am I going to get a voice? And someone will say, no, you can't go this way. These are the steps you have to take. And if you take them, something good will happen.
Well, it is our hope that health plans like Affinity will provide some of that coordination and assistance for patients and for their providers, and you mentioned both. But in the circumstance that you're describing, we shared a patient who actually had some socioeconomic challenges as well. So she fell in and out of health coverage during the period of time that we were trying to get care and to make care available to her. That's a real challenge, something that New York State is addressing, beginning to think about, especially with the new administration here.
So you mentioned Affinity, which is obviously the company you work with. Can you, even I'm confused by this whole concept of what Medicare, Medicaid, HMOs are, and you know, what is Affinity? How does that fit into with what a Medicare, Medicaid, HMO is?
Great. Well, first, Medicaid. Medicaid is really a program, primarily state-funded and administered, that is addressing the needs of lower-income residents primarily, also disabled and some other groups as well. Medicare is our program, national program, for those who usually age in or have some other reason for coverage like disability and so on.
So if you could, can you describe, just so people out there know, I mean, so then what are the quick qualifications for Medicare and what are the quick qualifications for Medicaid? I mean, how much money can't you make, I guess, and how old do you have to be for Medicare?
Most of the programs we're talking about revolve around the federal poverty level. So they're set at pretty low amounts, and the specifics are very complex because there are a lot of requirements. You didn't ask me that yet, but we're going to find, as we discuss this, that it's not only how much money you make, but where your assets are, also your family relationships. There are a load of requirements that people have to meet in order to qualify for not only Medicaid, but Child Health Plus, if you're a child, and Family Health Plus, which in New York State is an extension program for adults only.
So now where does that then relate to Affinity?
Affinity is what we would call a facilitated enroller. We actually, as part of our role, help citizens and residents of our area enroll into a healthcare program that applies to them. We not only enroll into Affinity, we will enroll into any health plan of the person's choice whose qualifications they meet.
So give us other examples. You know, are there hundreds of these companies out there that...
They're not hundreds, but there are many, many programs and throughout New York State. And in our area, around 20 programs. There are a lot to choose from.
Okay.
We find that, you know, those that we reach out to will choose a program based on a variety of reasons, whether or not their doctor belongs to that program, whether they've seen advertisement for that program, whether a family member or friend recommends it. So there are a variety of reasons why they choose.
So why would a person not join Affinity versus just sticking with, you know, vanilla Medicare and or Medicaid, depending upon that?
For Medicaid in New York State, most participants are required to join a managed care plan. You asked what an HMO is. A health maintenance organization, or HMO, is a plan that drives care through a primary care model, meaning there's a main physician or provider, nurse, for example, who will provide coordination of care. So all of these plans are health maintenance organizations, and that's really what their managed care piece is. So for Medicaid, there is little choice. If you're a Medicaid recipient, most likely you will have to join a managed care plan. Medicare is different. There are Medicare Advantage plans. There's an opportunity for managed care, but Medicare recipients are not required to join managed care plans.
Okay. So help make this easy for me. You're dealing with an underserved population. You're dealing with a population in the Medicaid world where not everybody is smart enough to figure out all these rules and regulations. And in the Medicare population, they're older and maybe a little bit more confused sometimes. Mm. I mean, where does the system help people navigate through all of this?
Well, on the Medicaid side, you're right. It is very complex. There are agencies obviously available not only for residents to seek help, but also are seeking to help residents. So there's a lot of outreach actually to help residents of New York State understand the opportunities to access health care. Affinity is one. We're designated as one of those agencies. I think that's an important part of our program, the fact that we reach out to advertise, to invite, and to encourage those who may be eligible to join a plan. For Medicaid recipients, our message probably is, it's important for you to join that plan so we can help you, just as you said, navigate the system. I think that's the main message that we're all driving home to those who may be eligible.
Yeah. So how long have these HMO, Medicare, Medicaid systems been in place?
Since the late 80s, actually, in New York State, in terms of managed care. So it's been quite a while.
Is it a national movement, or are they available in all the other states as well?
I can't speak for every state because every state is different, but there's usually some model like this in most states in the country. And some of the rules may vary, some of the specifics, but all with a similar goal.
And I'm in Medicare, Medicaid, HMO affinity today, and I decide to move to Massachusetts tomorrow. Does it move with me? Is it portable? Or do I have to start all over again?
In most instances, you probably have to start all over again. Most of the plans are locally focused, and certainly the state plans are.
So there could be incredible variability then between states.
Yes, that is true.
Which is, let me ask you, which is the best state to be in?
New York. Well, we do see in the news that many of these states are actually implementing very interesting models, testing models, to make these kinds of systems work better. Massachusetts is an example, Texas, Florida, New Mexico, many states, Tennessee, have paid a lot of attention, California, to trying to make this go well.
Okay. So I'm out there listening to this on the radio, and I'm wondering, geez, maybe I qualify. What type of patient wants to get into, should get into, needs to get into Affinity Health Plan?
We're going to say anyone without insurance should test to see whether or not they're eligible for this kind of program. That's our general message.
Okay. And so they would just walk into an Affinity office, and someone will sit down with them and, you know, go through their qualifications.
That's one way to do it. It's also available on almost many of the street corners of New York City and the surrounding counties. Most of the plans are out there trying to help you get information about that if you are uninsured.
Really?
Yes.
So the information is really, really accessible now. So I don't understand why then, let's go back to the first question I asked you, why are there 40 million people walking around without insurance?
I think part of it is fear. Because in order to qualify for the kinds of programs we're talking about, there's a lot of documentation that has to be presented, some that may be sensitive or of concern. Mm-hmm. Some you may not. We find that many times residents don't even have all that information available to them. Mm-hmm. And then it's just lack of information, lack of a health reason to join.
Yeah. So do we think, that 40 or 46 million, depending upon the statistic of the month, that really, what percentage of those people do you think would actually qualify for Medicare or Medicaid?
For Medicare, it's probably easier to know. Medicare eligibility is much cleaner. For Medicaid, though, it's hard to know, and the other programs that I talked about, because the eligibility is fluid and can be very difficult to assess. So I don't think anyone knows what percentage would qualify, probably not 100%.
Yeah. So you're saying close to 100% might qualify.
On the Medicare side.
On the Medicare side. So I guess what I'm trying to get at is this whole politically charged thing that some of the, obviously, people running for office nowadays are throwing out there as strikes against the people that are in office now really isn't true, because there is insurance that's available for these people.
There's some, but we definitely know that there should be more. And we are most concerned about our vulnerable populations, like children, for example. So it becomes a very interesting balance to make sure that our most vulnerable do have access first, and then the remainder also have access so that they don't become vulnerable.
In terms of children, if the parents have insurance through like Affinity Healthcare, they're automatically covered, correct?
Not all the time.
Really?
The eligibility requirements can differ, and we can even have families with different kinds of health insurance within Affinity.
We're going to have to take a short break. Please stay with us as we find out what types of patients don't have health insurance, who qualifies for Medicare and Medicaid, what types of patients get into Medicare, Medicaid, HMOs, and what are the other groups that exist besides Affinity? Please stay with us. Welcome back to How to Save Your Life. I'm Dr. Philip Stieg, and as my guest this evening, I have Dr. Susan J. Bean, the Senior Vice President and Chief Medical Officer of Affinity Health Plan. This is an independent, not-for-profit managed care plan designed to meet the needs of the underserved residents in the New York metropolitan area. And before we left, we were talking a little bit about, you know, the types of patients that would qualify for an affinity health plan type of insurance system. Let me ask you this. Do you think that a lot of people don't have insurance just because they think it's their lucky day and they're not going to need it?
I think that's a problem, definitely. And I think that we all need to consider the fact that at some point, even though we're well, we may need care. And even though we currently are doing well, we may be at that point without health insurance.
So there's, you know, I mean, common sense says you should have it just because it's a crapshoot. Some people, they'll have it, but then all of a sudden they change jobs, like you said earlier. What can they do when they're transitioning jobs or moving from state to state? You know, how do they plan for being without insurance?
I think it's a part of planning for your health, and most of us sort of take our health care as it comes. There are safety net providers that are available to us in most of our communities, either municipal programs or federally qualified health centers, for example, that are prepared to accept patients who have low or no income and still provide for their needs. And in addition, it's really being cognizant that if we don't do prevention, we can be caught in an emergent situation, which is much, much more difficult to manage.
Mm-hmm. Are there specific insurance companies or state-run organizations that will help somebody in that transition phase?
Oh, absolutely. And again, we spoke about the kinds of agencies and all the health plans. I mean, we've been speaking about Affinity, but the list is very long. Some of the names people in this area will recognize. AmeriChoice, Fidelis, Metro Plus, Health Plus. These are signs for health plans that we see in our area.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, aside from the cost of health care, we keep reading in the newspaper that there's a health crisis in the United States and, you know, in our state. Is it more of a, not really a health crisis, but more of an informational crisis that, I mean, it seems to me that the stuff is there. You are out there on the street corner with your group and other groups trying to give health care, trying to provide the coverage so that they can get good health care. Mm-hmm. So we need more advertisements on TV and on the radio? Is that
right? And this is what we're challenged with all the time. Why, if all this information is available, why are people not taking advantage? But as you know, it's not just enough to know. You have to be able and willing to act on that information, and that's usually driven by whether or not a person feels it applies to them. I think we're in a society that focuses on the beautiful, the healthy, and the good outcomes, when in fact we all should be thinking about what we're at risk for, depending on our age and our, you know, where we are in life and so on, and that would, I think, help us to act more reasonably around these kinds of these choices.
So do you think a lot of it is because people are younger and they're feeling lucky and they just, I don't need it today? And that leads into the question then is, does Affinity and these other groups, do they attract patients that are finally sick and they go, oops, now I need somebody and I need something?
We attract both. I think more and more of our members and our communities are looking for solutions that are not emergent and are beginning to act on information that has been available to them. I would also say that this is an economic choice, because if I'm choosing between taking my time to go register for a health plan today or scavenge for food for my family, I might not choose my health plan today. So it's a very complex interaction between factors. We try to appeal to folks and make it easy for them to make that good choice for themselves.
Just as an aside, I know that you are on the state program for looking at bariatric surgery, and, you know, thinking about that as it relates to preventive medicine, is that the classic example of trying to get the person before they're obese? And, you know, how does Affinity deal with that problem? If somebody comes in and they're overweight, what are you going to do for them?
Absolutely. It certainly is a classic example of reaping, you know, the health deficit. Detriment that occurs because of some of it behavioral, some of it just social problems and health problems, we make that surgery available to our members. And I think that's what we can do. And we also work with primary care providers and other doctors and providers so that they are knowledgeable that this service is available. Bariatric surgery is a very interesting scenario because those who are going for bariatric surgery are the sickest of the sick, if you will, and often really are facing a very poor health outcome if they don't have the surgery.
So, you know, help clear up, I think, what is a little bit of the, you know, the misperception of the public out there. You know, I would think that, you know, listen, that person's morbidly obese, they've been eating too much, drinking too much, they're not taking care of themselves, they obviously don't care about themselves. Why should I, as a citizen, have to pay more taxes so that they can have this very high-end type of surgery?
Well, this is a problem that's pervasive in our communities. We do know that morbid obesity or extreme obesity is not just a problem of behavior, but it's also physiologic. In fact, literally, these are patients who cannot solve this problem for themselves without some significant intervention. We know that the benefit for to having surgery is not only for that individual, but also for society at large. And we also understand that if we can solve obesity, hopefully not through surgery, but through other means as well, that we will have a more productive society. Those are people that are now back into a position where they are, you know, able to work better, live better, play better, and to remain healthy. So clearly the benefits outweigh the deficits for that particular surgery, but it is extreme.
So when we think about these Medicare, Medicaid, HMOs, who really benefits? Is it the government because you've been able to manage it a little bit better and cut the cost? Is it the rest of the public who pays taxes? Their taxes are lower because you're managing it better? Is it the physician who's kind of stuck in the middle and trying to figure out the rules of Medicare and Medicaid and also trying to take care of their patient? Or is it the patient? I mean, does the patient actually benefit from all this?
Well, I think that all the groups that you mentioned benefit. I definitely think that the government benefits because we are administering a program that for them would be very onerous. We're actually closer to the action, often local, and we are able to do some things better for both the provider, the patient, and that definitely benefits the government as a payer. But those are our dollars. So to the extent that we're doing a better job with those dollars, more patients are able to access those services, and they're available to us if we ever need them. I think that providers and patients benefit because we're able to help support that patient-physician-patient-provider relationship with programs and funds that make it more robust and more meaningful. Obviously, just if you just look at the patient alone, the opportunity to be lost in the system is not as great because we as health plans are held to standards. We are reporting out on a routine basis whether these members are actually accessing services, whether they are achieving quality outcomes, which I know we're going to talk about. So there's sort of another set of eyes watching this patient-physician interaction.
That's what I was curious about. You know, I mean, again, the Post loves to dig into Medicare, Medicaid fraud and that. Is it as easy as the Post would lead you to believe, or is there somebody really watching over these groups quite closely?
We are monitored, but we ourselves monitor because we don't want to see providers benefiting from the conditions that our patients have or the care of the patients unduly. But generally, we are actually contracting with physicians and other providers who generally want to provide good care. And it's always a pleasure for me to interact with them, to really thank them for going out of their way to care for these patients who are more vulnerable.
Now, you're the chief medical officer of one of these groups. I mean, how many people do you cover?
We cover over 200,000 members.
So you're responsible for the management of the health and lives of 200,000 people. That's a significant responsibility. In addition to that, you manage how many physicians are within your organization?
Well, in our network, we have about 10,000.
10,000 physicians.
Physicians.
So from your position, do you think that most of the docs are trying to do the right stuff and really trying to help patients?
I really do, especially on the Medicaid side where these providers are joining us because it has been their life's work in many instances to care for these patients.
Mm-hmm. Well, I look at you and I wonder, why do you do this rather than go and set up a nice Upper East Side, Upper West Side practice? What makes you do, where was it in Philadelphia that you worked with the Healthy Streets, mm-hmm. I believe it, mm-hmm. and that's something else that you've brought into being mm-hmm. through your own force of will. What makes you tick?
Well, I've always been very interested in the policy side of healthcare, and I think that's partially because I'm a New York City resident who had to, from a middle-class family, and I had to find healthcare. My family did as best that they could, and I have had some good health outcomes because we found good doctors and providers able to care for us. But at the same time, I saw people in my neighborhood and around the city who were not able to have those advantages, and I think that's always stuck with me. So I have practiced, but I actually love the opportunity to apply what I know in terms of medicine and policy to a large number of people and then to help providers serve them.
Mm-hmm. So I'll tell you, my image of a chief medical officer for an insurance corporation is the person that I do battle with to justify care for a patient. Is that a realistic impression, and why not if it isn't?
I think that happens much less than it used to. Actually, physicians are held to a high standard as medical directors within our state. So we have some requirements to adjudicate care in a reasonable manner and the way that we should according to our training and our licensure. But in addition to that, my philosophy is that our job is to make that care happen in the way that these providers see best. And we honor the care space where the physician and the patient meet. So with that philosophy in mind, I think that most of the interactions are actually quite positive. And we're expecting that the services our providers are looking to provide are the right services for our members.
I went onto the webpage and looked up a little bit about Affinity Healthcare, and I think one of the things that was emphasized was this concept of disease management groups. Mm-hmm. Teach me, what is that?
We know that the most vulnerable of our members are those with chronic illness. They are the ones that are likely to fall through the cracks because they are unable to negotiate the system even as well as they might if they were well. So hypertension, diabetes, asthma, and COPD.
COPD being emphysema?
Right. Yep. Thank you. So we pay a lot of attention to those members. And our disease management program is really designed in two ways. One is to find the members who may have fallen out of the system and fallen into the hospital, the emergency room, and return them to a more stable health environment. That's really acting on the treatment plan that those providers and physicians have put in place. So that's sort of the most at risk. And then we are developing programs to try to keep people, our members, in that stable health environment so that their primary care and specialty physicians, their pharmacists, and so on, are providing the majority of care for them. I think the final piece, which is very interesting, is how to empower our members to care for themselves to the extent that they play a role in good health outcomes. So that's how we approach it. We approach it, though, very cautiously because it's not always clear that our intervention is the most important intervention from the managed care seat.
Mm-hmm. So is this all coordinated by the primary care physician? I mean, you just listed off a number of things that you do, and who's the captain of that ship?
We try to make the captain of the ship the primary care provider. We really do. And so all of the programs flow back in that direction.
Okay, so let's think about this practically then. Your primary care doctor, how many patients do they see a day in your practice?
Well, most of them are saying that they see patients every 15 minutes. They probably take a little break for lunch. So in 8 hours, that's a lot of patients.
Yeah. So when in the day then do they have the time to do the phone work to make sure that somebody got their physical therapy or somebody filled their prescription? I guess what I'm getting at is, sort of dual responsibilities. The physician tries to do the right thing, but the patient doesn't necessarily always do the things they're supposed to do.
Mm-hmm. That's a dilemma. Most of our practices, they'll find the time to try to coordinate care for those members that need it. When they don't, we try to pick up the ball and run with it to the extent that we can, to the extent that we can find the member and they can't, to the extent that we have information, for example, that the member didn't fill a prescription as their physician expected. If we can make the intervention, then we will. sometimes reminders and so on. But I think it's a delicate balance.
So one thing I wanted to get back to is, you know, you listed a number of major diseases that are easily seen. You know, somebody with asthma is easy to pick up. High blood pressure is easy to pick up. Obesity, those sorts of things. Earlier you referred to the people that fall in the cracks. Like, where do the kids fit in this? I would think that preventive medicine and continued visits to the pediatrician on a regular basis are extremely important to you. How do they not fall in the cracks?
Well, that's a sort of a shared responsibility between actually the parents, the primary care physician, and a health plan. But you're right. Most children are seeking care and finding care within the system someplace. We also find that another partner could be our schools. So it's a shared responsibility. If you're talking about very young children, we tend to find that over 90% of them are connected with care and we know about it, meaning that a physician has billed us for that care. There may be a small percentage that we don't know about. There may be a small percentage that is receiving care in school, etc. As children age, it's harder to know for sure that they're connected with care. And it's a real struggle. Teens are our biggest struggle. 40% of our health plan is composed of teenagers or preteens. So we spend a lot of time tracking their care and paying attention to whether they're receiving all the kind of counseling, screening, and care that they need.
From your perspective, what are the major health care issues that you deal with in the teenage population?
The scary ones like sex, violence, drugs, alcohol, driving when they, intoxicate, etc. All those concerns that we even as parents would have are health concerns for teens because that's where they're really, really at risk.
So have you seen that you've been able to have any impact? I think the statistics suggest that actually, teenage smoking is up now.
Absolutely.
That's a frightening thought that the next generation will probably have worse lung disease. Mm-hmm. What does Affinity do about things like that?
We do track and spend a lot of time with medical record review and providing tools to our PCPs to help them when they're working with our teens. But in addition, we actually publish an adolescent directory and information guide either annually or biannually to help teens negotiate the system, and we do it in their language. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned Healthy Streets. That's a big part of it, is sort of providing information in a way that's sensitive to how a teen might want to hear it and know it.
And you said that you try to work with the schools. I mean, do you go out and do health fairs, or do you give talks at the public schools and private schools as well to try to reduce the incidence of this?
We do when invited. It's not always so easy. Obviously, that's a whole other system apart from the healthcare delivery system. But we have spent some time doing some related activities around teen concerns, something that's a corollary that gives us an opportunity to also talk about health.
So from your point of view, then, do you think that basically we're talking about modifying behavior as part of the teenage healthcare problems? You know, the things that you listed off: sex, alcohol, drinking and driving,
smoking.
All of those things are extremely preventable. How do we do a better job of changing their approach towards life?
The first is actually just screening and asking. That's the biggest hurdle with teens, because most are quite willing to talk with their physician or provider. In fact, they often prefer to talk with their physician or provider rather than their parents. So if we can get our providers to just ask the questions and to open up that conversation, they have an opportunity to really modify outcomes for those teens.
Please stay with us. We'll return in a moment and find out what challenges does Medicare and Medicaid face? What do you as a patient in that system face? And what does the physician face? And how can we communicate better both between the patient, the physician, and your healthcare group? We'll be right back. Welcome back to How to Save Your Life. I'm Dr. Philip Stieg, your host, and I'm with Dr. Susan J. Bean, the Senior Vice President and Chief Medical Officer of Affinity Health Plan here in New York State. Susan, during the break we were talking a little bit about the concept of health literacy. What do you mean by that?
We talked earlier in the program about the ability to access information about health, but we now know for sure that if you have that information, yet it's not given to you in a way that you can use it, it's almost useless. So we are spending a lot of time and energy trying to figure out how we can best deliver health information so that our patients or our members or people in general can actually act on it in the way that will promote health for them.
So in the last segment, you talked about the fact that teens, which are an extremely difficult group to manage in regard to healthcare, surprisingly, are extremely willing to see the doctor, talk about their problems, get examined. And then we jump to, what, the early 20s, mid-20s, and all of a sudden people aren't practicing good health. What happens?
I think that they lose their enthusiasm for accessing the healthcare system because we haven't historically been that responsive to teens. What an opportunity, though, to keep them engaged and throughout their life, you know, using some good lessons around accessing healthcare.
So you think the state government is really focusing on trying to increase health literacy in the teen population with the hope that it will carry over then into the adult population?
Absolutely, and many health plans are doing the same. That is definitely one of the big points of focus for us.
Another issue that you brought up was this choice between health care and eating. Mm-hmm. Give me an example of how that plays out in real life.
From our vantage point, one of the most striking ways is when we're looking at patients in the hospital who are receiving a discharge plan or being asked to stay for a longer period of time in the hospital. And they will relate to us that they have to leave because they may lose their job. Many of us take for granted the fact that we have sick days and vacation days, but these are our people, patients, members of our community whose lives are so much on the margin, you know, that if they lose a few days of work, they may not have a place to live, they may not have food to eat, and so on.
So it becomes this self-perpetuating snowball that just it actually keeps getting bigger. They leave the hospital, try to go back to work, and then they get sicker.
Absolutely right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you see any change coming down the road that's going to help people not get into that cycle?
I think that the healthcare delivery system is becoming more savvy, and I think this is the positive message that we certainly can leave your audience with, and that is that more providers are responding to their communities with hours that are more reasonable, with home programs that can support a discharge plan, for example, from the hospital, with alternatives that are not traditional, for making sure that healthcare is accessible, reasonable, and literate as well.
Mm-hmm. Does a program like Affinity provide some non-traditional kind of healthcare for your patients, meaning acupuncture, things that just don't fall into the, I'm going to go get a physical exam, get my shots, and come home? Do you do that?
We don't generally. It's really dependent upon what the benefit structure is and what we have available to offer our members. But where we can, we do make them aware of community resources that can help them access those kinds of alternatives, as you said, on their own.
Mm-hmm. So you sit at the top of this mountain, an administrator of 200,000 lives and 10,000 physicians. There must be for both the patients, physicians, and you as an administrator, a number of challenges that you see coming down the road. Could you go through some of those for each one of those groups? You, the provider, you, the insurance company, the physician stuck in the middle, and the patient.
I would start with just the challenge in finding the members that we want to serve. That consumes a lot of our time and our discussions, just where are these folks that we want to find and make sure that they enroll in a health plan. So that's a big challenge for us. We're always challenged with finding the members once they're enrolled with us because of their socioeconomic problems, phone numbers, addresses can change very quickly. On the provider side, the administrative burden, the rules, So many health plans, so many forms, so many hoops to jump through. We're always trying to think about how we can make that better for them. And also they're facing economic challenges.
It seems like to me, just listening to you, it's an overwhelming task. You know, I mean, thinking of each one of the groups, if you're a patient who doesn't have a home, like you said, they lose their phone numbers. I mean, it's not a, what you're describing, it's not a happy existence. Mm-hmm. They're going to the physician meets them, tries to do the right thing, tries to set up some plan, but then the patient doesn't follow up. Do you have a lot of physician burnout?
Yes, there is a lot of physician burnout. We, however, try to sit in the middle of that ring and make things flow as smoothly as possible. And I would say the majority of time we have success. I think that there are some services that we can offer to patients and physicians that make a difference.
What are some outcomes that you say we've been successful, okay? And you also say that you measure outcomes. Give me some examples.
For our members with chronic illness, we have found that our PCPs and patients connect. So our members do connect with their PCPs around diabetes and hypertension. We consider that a great success.
By connect, you mean they have regular visits?
They have regular visits, just as we would hope they would, mm-hmm. to manage those conditions.
And that's something easily monitored because I'm sure it's digitalized and on a computer system.
Those are some of the data that we have available to us, you're right, through our systems. When we go to medical records, we find that the majority of our patients with chronic illness who have seen their providers are actually well controlled. So they're actually meeting the current standards for control of their disease and illness. That's a major success.
So what are you measuring there? Like a diabetic, I guess you're measuring their blood sugars?
We measure their A1C. Mm-hmm. And if you're a diabetic, you know that your doctor's always asking you about that. We measure whether or not their blood pressure's in control and whether or not their blood cholesterol and lipids are where they should be. Mm-hmm. So we measure all of those indicators that suggest that good care is happening.
And so then that also is an indicator that the patient is behaving and eating the right thing. So you're looking at the end result, and then you can work with modifying, hopefully, their behavior if they need it.
That's right. And we will also measure other things to help give the provider information. We'll measure how often they're on the right medications. We may measure BMI, the body mass index, which is our main measure for obesity. Mm-hmm. And then we can feed that information back to our providers to help them apply their resources where they can best be used.
So I'm a provider, and you. When you say we, I keep feeling like George Orwell, the big
yes.
brother. I mean, who is
yes.
we?
At Affinity, it's mainly our clinical staff. We have nurses and doctors working at Affinity, as well as other member services staff. We say we because when a member or a customer accesses Affinity, we want to make sure that they are achieving a consistent result. And people access us anyone can receive a phone call from a member or provider at Affinity. Mm-hmm. And our staff has certain guidelines and rules, protocols that we follow to try to make these outcomes happen.
So the information gets back to the primary care physician, the PCP, and then they call the patient or the office calls the patient and says, wait a minute, there's something wrong here, you need to come back in?
Whenever possible, we let the PCP determine how those phone calls should happen because it eliminates a step, eliminates an extra handoff, if you will. But occasionally, we will make appointments for providers or for members if that's helpful to them. We will make those appointments as well.
I would think another measure of your success as a company, the Affinity Group, would be kind of turnover in your patient population. You say you've got 200,000. Now, is that the same 200,000 you had 10 years ago, or is it a new 200,000?
That's a great question. Probably around 40% stay with us over an extended period of time, beyond a year. We call that churning in our business. Uh-huh. And churning, if you will, is a significant problem, much of which is driven by the requirements for eligibility and whether or not that member actually connects back to the state to stay on the program for which they are eligible. The Governor Spitzer's office is very concerned about this, and it's a major, major issue in terms of assuring good health outcomes. You're absolutely correct.
Yeah, because, I mean, again, if there's turnover every other year, that means there's no continuity. And either they're going to get plugged into another system or no system at all. So What are we doing to try to prevent that from happening?
Well, I think we partner with group practices, community health centers, federally qualified health centers that are able to maintain a relationship with our patients or members of the community, whether or not they're in our plan. Also, some of the hospital institutions can do that as well. But we also do a lot of outreach around the time when that, what we call it, recertification or re-enrollment has to happen, to help with paperwork, to remind, and to hopefully ensure that our eligible members stay on with us.
So the good witch comes down and says to you, you know, there's been a transition at the state governor's level, and we want to try to help you, help Medicare and Medicaid. I mean, where does the system need help?
I think you highlighting churning is a major, major opportunity for the system, keeping people enrolled, also opening up enrollment to those who are eligible, making it easy for them to enroll in a plan. Those are two major, major areas. And I think the third is just understanding the nature of some of the barriers and challenges and disconnects and working to bring us together so that we can solve them.
And is the target or should the target group be, from what I'm hearing from you, that 18 to 22-year-old age group where, you know, you're telling me the teens want the information and then they sort of fall out of it, and I don't know how many of your population that you're talking about go on to college, so we still have them in school until they're 18. Mm-hmm. Is that who we should be trying to target?
That's certainly one vulnerable group, but young children are especially vulnerable, and I think the focus will be on children up to age 19. We can only imagine that you can't redeem many of the issues that can arise with those children if they're not addressed immediately and in the right way.
Mm-hmm. I guess one of my concerns would be that the issues you talked about, the healthcare concerns for the teen is, again, violence or violence-related or mm-hmm. Drugs, alcohol, and that sort of thing. Is that something we can really expect the healthcare system to fix, or do we need to have another plan for trying to address the home situations?
I think you've hit on something important, and that is that most of the determinants of health are not sort of in this small domain that we've been talking about, even the physician-patient relationship. It's what goes on day-to-day in the lives of, in this case, in teens and so on. Where do they live? Where do they go to school? Do they have someone helping them at home? Who cooks dinner for them? Who helps them to, choose good health behaviors, if you will? So all those factors have to be addressed in tandem.
Do you think that there are unfair expectations then of physicians? And do we need to educate the public about what they can really fairly expect from us in terms of their health care?
I think that's part of it. I do think, though, that we have to do we have to play our appropriate role, and we have to, no one can write a prescription for a patient except the provider that understands the evidence and knows that prescription should be written. So there's still a lot of room for improvement in how we deliver care once we have a person in the office. That's where health literacy is important. That's where follow-up is important, coordination. But clearly we have to be able to coordinate with all of the other social institutions that play a role, churches, temples, synagogues, etc., even where we buy our food. All of those community agencies and organizations play a role.
Is that sort of this concept of healthy streets something that you've thought of and implemented? Is that what it's about?
It really is. It's really understanding how a person in a community is impacted by the various kinds of health determinants that make a difference in whether or not they are healthy or not. And it's something that we have really enjoyed implementing at Affinity because the feedback has been so positive. And we try to send out literature. We try to make phone calls when appropriate. And then we try to also go out into the community with workshops as we can to really pass on information and help our community residents make good choices.
So you're obviously, you're a young woman. You're committed.
Thank you.
Committed to healthcare in New York City. Where do you go next? Do you want to expand Healthy Streets, or do you want to expand Affinity Healthcare to a million members? What are your goals?
We are really interested in making sure that the data and information that we collect over time is of value to all of those who are trying to make a difference in the public health arena. So we spend a lot of time trying to use our information, trying to expand knowledge, and trying to help create innovative approaches to the problems that we've talked about. And I think the other place is health literacy. I think that if we can really touch our members and help them understand and act on the information that's available to them, we will have made a big difference in health outcomes for them and in a way that's satisfying to them.
So is that healthcare literacy then really related to, it's got to be closely linked to the schools. If the person's not articulate, you can't explain to them what their healthcare issues are.
That's true. And in addition to that, venue, we also find that those of us who are well-educated may not understand jargon, may not really understand how to take our medications, and may have questions that we have not historically felt comfortable asking our providers.
I look at a personal situation. My mother, who's 85 years old, there but by the grace of God, and my father, who figures out her pills every morning,
right.
She would be totally confused. Mm-hmm. And if she didn't have him, and she didn't have any insurance, what would an individual like that do in your system?
We would have to play some of that role. We would have to find out what resources we could apply to make sure that nursing care helps her, or that she's connected to a community agency for help, or even connected directly to us in some instances. But you're right, we all benefit from understanding how healthcare delivery works, how our health care impacts us, and what we can do about it. So that's a great example. Could be any of us, right?
Exactly. Our time will come. Susan, it's been a pleasure having this hour to talk with you, and I hope that we've been able to shed some light for our listeners on how to manage the healthcare system, both if you do qualify for Medicare and Medicaid, but also the complexity that actually exists even for people with private insurance carriers. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.